Fred Ebb's Overture to the popular American stage musical Cabaret, based on Christopher Isherwood's Berlin stories. And to celebrate Gay Pride Month, Mr. Isherwood is the subject for this week's From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive's weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Today we will hear a number of rare recordings of Mr. Isherwood, including a play written by Isherwood and W.H. Auden in 1937 and produced at KPFK Studios in 1962. But before we let you hear Mr. Isherwood, let's get some of the basics. Christopher Isherwood was born in England in 1904, came to the U.S. in 1939, and lived in Santa Monica from then until his death in 1986. His literary career began in 1928 with the publication of his first novel, All the Conspirators, and he's probably best known for the Berlin stories. Stories that fictionalize his life in pre-World War II Berlin, and that were adapted as the stage play I Am a Camera and the popular musical Cabaret. And now let's listen to Christopher Isherwood reading from The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin on From the Vault.
The Last of Mr. Norris is a book which describes a single character, Mr. Norris, who is a sort of gentlemanly crook, essentially a small-time crook, who is dabbling rather dangerously in deep waters. He plays around a little with espionage, with the communists, with various forces which are a great deal too big for him. He is, by temperament, a character who is much happier with a little modest blackmail and the arrangement of deals. This character is presented as a sympathetic character, and many have found him so, although, as one critic once said, he has not one single redeeming feature. The I of this novel, who incidentally is not named Christopher Isherwood, but William Bradshaw, which were the two middle names of my full name. I dropped them when I became an American citizen because Christopher Isherwood is quite enough load to carry through life without the other two. William goes to see him, at his suggestion, in Berlin. And this is a description of William's first visit to Mr. Norris's apartment. Mr. Norris had two front doors to his flat. They stood side by side. Both had peepholes in the center and brightly polished knobs and brass nameplates. On the left-hand plate was engraved Arthur Norris, Private, and on the right hand, Arthur Norris, Export and Import. After a moment's hesitation, I pressed the button of the left-hand bell. The bell was startlingly loud. It must have been clearly audible all over the flat. Nevertheless, nothing happened. No sound came from within. I was just about to ring again when I became aware that an eye was regarding me through the peephole in the door. How long it had been there, I didn't know. I felt embarrassed and uncertain whether to stare the eye out of its hole or merely pretend that I hadn't seen it. I examined the ceiling, the floor, the walls, then ventured a furtive glance to make sure that it had gone. It hadn't. Vexed, I turned my back on the door altogether. Nearly a minute passed. When finally I did turn around, it was because the other door, the export and import door, had opened, and a young man stood on the threshold. "Is Mr. Norris in?" I asked. The young man eyed me suspiciously. He had watery light yellow eyes and a blotched complexion the colour of porridge. His head was huge and round, set awkwardly on a short, plump body. He wore a smart lounge suit and patent leather shoes. I didn't like the look of him at all. "Have you an appointment?" "Yes." My tone was extremely curt. At once the young man's face curved into oily smiles. "Oh, it's Mr. Bradshaw. One moment, if you please." My astonishment, he closed the door in my face, only to reappear an instant later at the left-hand door, standing aside for me to enter the flat. This behaviour seemed all the more extraordinary because, as I noticed immediately I was inside, the private side of the entrance hall was divided from the export side only by a thick hanging curtain. "Mr. Norris wishes me to say that he will be with you in one moment," said the big-headed young man, treading delicately across the thick carpet on the toes of his patent leather shoes. He spoke very softly, as if he were afraid of being overheard. Opening the door of a large sitting room, he silently motioned me to take a chair and withdrew. Left alone, I looked around me slightly mystified. Everything was in good taste, the carpet, the colour scheme, but the room was curiously without character. It was like a room on the stage or in the window of a high-class furnishing store. Elegant, expensive, discreet. I had expected Mr. Norris's background to be altogether more exotic. Something Chinese would have suited him, with golden and scarlet dragons. The young man had left the door ajar. "The gentleman is here, sir." And now, with even greater distinctness, Mr. Norris's voice was audible as he replied from behind a door in the opposite wall of the sitting room, "Oh, is he? Thank you." I wanted to laugh. This little comedy was so unnecessary as to seem slightly sinister. A moment later, Mr. Norris himself came into the room, nervously rubbing his manicured hands together. "My dear boy, this is indeed an honour. Delighted to welcome you under the shadow of my humble roof tree." He didn't look well, I thought. His face wasn't so rosy today, and there were rings under his eyes. He sat down for a moment in an armchair, but rose again immediately, as if he were not in the mood for sitting still. The rest of this book describes how William gradually became involved with Mr. Norris and his plots and plans, and in the end very nearly got into some extremely melodramatic trouble. The book is basically melodramatic, perhaps one should say a kind of melodramatic political farce. My second book about Berlin, Goodbye to Berlin, is altogether more serious in its basic intention, although it contains a number of comic figures. The best known of these is the girl called Sally Bowles, and her story was dramatized by John Van Druten, my great friend, now dead, to make a play called I Am a Camera, the title being a quotation from a passage in this book. I'll read you now a description of my first meeting with Sally Bowles from Goodbye to Berlin. One afternoon early in October, I was invited to black coffee at Fritz Wendell's flat. Fritz always invited you to black coffee, with emphasis on the black. He was very proud of his coffee. People used to say that it was the strongest in Berlin. Fritz himself was dressed in his usual coffee party costume, a very thick white yachting sweater and very light blue flannel trousers. He greeted me with his full-lipped, luscious smile. "Hello, Chris." "Hello, Fritz. How are you?" Fine. He bent over the coffee machine, his sleek black hair unplastering itself from his scalp and falling in richly scented locks over his eyes. This darn thing doesn't go, he added. How's business, I asked. Lousy and terrible, Fritz grinned richly. Or I pull off a new deal in the next month, or I go as a gigolo. Either or, I corrected, from force of professional habit. I'm speaking a lousy English just now, drawled Fritz with great self-satisfaction. Sally says maybe she'll give me a few lessons. Who's Sally? Why, I forgot you don't know Sally. Too bad of me. Eventually she's coming around here this afternoon. Is she nice? Fritz rolled his naughty black eyes, handing me a rum-moistened cigarette from his patent tin. Marvellous, he drawled. Eventually I believe I'm getting crazy about her. Oh, who is she? What does she do? She's an English girl, an actress. Sings at the Lady Windermere. Hot stuff, believe me. A few minutes later, Sally herself arrived. Am I terribly late, Fritz, darling? Only half of an hour, I suppose, Fritz drawled, beaming with proprietary pleasure. May I introduce Mr. Isherwood, Miss Bowles? Mr. Isherwood is commonly known as Chris. I'm not, I said. Fritz is about the only person who's ever called me Chris in my life. Do you mind if I use your telephone, sweet? Sure, go ahead. Fritz caught my eye. Come into the other room, Chris. I want to show you something. He was evidently longing to hear my first impressions of Sally, his new acquisition. For heaven's sake, don't leave me alone with this man, she exclaimed, or he'll seduce me down the telephone. He's most terribly passionate. As she dialed the number, I noticed that her fingernails were painted emerald green, a colour unfortunately chosen, for it called attention to her hands, which were much stained by cigarette smoking and as dirty as a little girl's. She was dark enough to be Fritz's sister. Her face was long and thin, powdered white. She had very large brown eyes, which should have been darker, to match her hair and the pencil she used for her eyebrows. Hello, she cooed, pursing her brilliant cherry lips as though she were going to kiss the mouthpiece. Ist das du, mein Liebling? Her voice opened in a fatuously sweet smile. Fritz and I sat watching her like a performance at the theatre. Was wollen wir machen? Morgan Abend. Oh, wie wunderbar! Nein, nein, ich werde bleiben heute Abend zu Hause. Ja, ja, ich werde wirklich bleiben zu Hause. Auf Wiedersehen, mein Liebling. She hung up the receiver and turned to us triumphantly. That's the man I slept with last night, she announced. He makes love marvellously. He's an absolute genius at business, and he's terribly rich. She came and sat down on the sofa beside Fritz, sinking back into the cushions with a sigh. Give me some coffee, will you, darling? I'm simply dying of thirst. And soon we were on to Fritz's favourite topic, love. He pronounced it larve.
Earlier this week, we had the good fortune of talking to Sue Hodson, curator of literary manuscripts at the Huntington Library, about the significance of Isherwood and the Pacifica Radio Archive recordings.
The library is the proud home of the Christopher Isherwood Archives. We received this collection in about 1999, and 5 years later was the centenary of his birth. 2004, and we did an exhibition about Christopher Isherwood, highlighting his life and career. It was a spectacular success. We were extremely gratified at the reception and the high attendance that came with the exhibition. Public visitors just flocked in and really delved into Isherwood's life and career. We had meetings, we had concert series to go with it, we had symposia, lectures, readings of Isherwood's works. It was just a festive summer and a time of great rejoicing in his life.
Let's talk about Christopher Isherwood's voice, and what does it mean to scholars when they hear the actual author?
That kind of documentary evidence is absolutely critically important for scholars. When they can hear what the author was thinking about when he created a character, when he wrote a novel, it gives them insight behind that novel. It gives them insight into the way the author is thinking as he creates his work of literature. And that's why that's so important for scholars to have that kind of source available to them. The thing that I think is wonderful about Isherwood's voice and the pauses that he does is he clearly is forming his sentences so thoughtfully, so carefully, so that what he says, seemingly extemporaneously, is actually brilliantly planned. And that really supports what we see in the archive. I have never before seen an author who was so meticulous and so careful, so patient, so methodical in the way he went about writing his stories and books. Isherwood had, in my view, endless patience to rework and rework and rework until he got it just right. He took more than 7 years on The World in the Evening, and it got changed from third person to first person, back again, changed in its structure, changed in every way possible. And throughout, and we have this documented in the papers, you see him adjusting and refining and redefining everything about the novel. And to see this now behind the scenes for the Berlin Stories is really fascinating, to hear the thought that went into it, to hear his view of what the book is about. That's invaluable for scholars.
In 2003, Sue Hodson joined the Pacifica Radio Archives Advisory Panel to select the first 50 Pacifica Radio Archives recordings to be preserved as part of our first National Endowment for the Arts Preservation Grant. After identifying all the Christopher Isherwood recordings, the Pacifica Radio Archives staff digitized and then donated the CDs to the Christopher Isherwood papers at the Huntington Library. Here is Sue to tell us how the Archives Preservation Project has helped understand Isherwood.
It's immensely important for the archive to have these tapes, and the Huntington and I are both very grateful to you and the Pacifica Radio Archives for making that possible. Those tape recordings are listened to by scholars who flock in to the Huntington to do research on the Isherwood collection. And I might add that the Isherwood collection immediately became the second most heavily used collection, literary collection, in the library, which is pretty remarkable. So scholarship is thriving and galloping ahead for Isherwood. The reason the recordings are so important is to hear his own words, to hear his intonation, the way he speaks and the way he formulates his thought is really important for people to get a good sense of the man himself. And these recordings really serve that purpose. I think a lot of people are a little bit surprised that Isherwood's voice is a little bit high-pitched. And that's, I think, one of the more endearing things about him. It really humanizes him for people who approach him just through reading his works.
On August 30th, 1962, Christopher Isherwood gave a talk at the University of California, Berkeley, as part of a series entitled The Writer at Mid-Century, The Moral Crisis. Here is Christopher Isherwood's personal statement.
Let me talk a little about my conception of the writer and what I think the writer's duties are and what their nature is. There's a very convenient word in Sanskrit which has lately become quite popularized, although not always used correctly, the word dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A. Now, the word dharma meant originally the duties which pertained to any one of the Hindu castes. If you were Brahmin, you had one set of obligations. If you were Kshatriya, you had another set. If you were a merchant, you had another set, and so on and so forth. And the concept was that from a purely spiritual point of view, it was extremely dangerous to assume the duties, the dharma, of another group, because that wasn't what your nature intended you to do. Now, of course, it is many, many thousands of years since the caste system became all mixed up and lost its psychological relevance in this respect. But the concept of dharma is still something that can help us, and we can say to ourselves, I think, that if somebody has, for example, and this applies, needless to say, to an enormous variety of occupations, if somebody, for example, has the talent of being a writer, that this does impose certain duties. I prefer to think that they are duties primarily to himself, but of course they are duties which reflect or relate to other people as well. Now, in discussing this question of the writer's dharma, I've found myself again and again using the term, the convenient term, the outsider. Because I feel that there are a couple of very important distinctions to be drawn here about the writer's position in relation to society. I feel that the writer is an outsider in the sense that by very virtue of observing society and drawing back from it sufficiently to say something about it, or about the tiniest or largest part of it, it doesn't matter, he is necessarily putting himself in a certain sense outside society. How many other people are also outside society is, of course, neither here nor there. We're isolating the writer in discussing this. I'm not claiming any special status for the writer, but it's our business to discuss the writer this evening. Now, when you are outside society in this sense, as an outsider, as an observer, you are, of course, not hostile to society in the sense that a rebel is hostile. You may be a rebel and an outsider. You may go through a phase of rebellion, but not necessarily so. The outsider is really like a kind of friend outside a marriage or a friend outside a family who gives a kind of disinterested view of the matter. And the really important thing is that he does retain the power to react on every single new occasion as though it were the first occasion. What I mean by that is that normally, supposing we go along with a certain political group or a group of any other character, we pledge, at least for a fair amount of time, our loyalty to that group. And in our function as political beings, we have to do that for practical purposes. But the writer, as a writer, is constantly exercising a criticism. He cannot go along, and his assent, his temporary assent to anything, that he assents to is not the same as the ordinary assent of somebody who has joined a party. He isn't even like a loyal opposition, because a loyal opposition also has a kind of rigid attitude and is in fact always out to defeat the party in power and then to gain a kind of authority for itself. In the case of a writer, he doesn't want this authority at all. He simply asks and wants to observe and to participate at this curious kind of remove, to discover meaning in what he sees and observes, and to convey that meaning. And this, it seems to me, is a very important point to bear in mind when we go on to the question of the writer in his political involvement. You see, I think that when a writer writes, he writes for an X number of individuals, maybe for millions and millions, but he writes for each individual as an individual. This is, I believe, one of the differences between art and propaganda. I think that when you write for a lot of people, when you're writing propaganda, you're writing for them in the mass, and which is quite a different thing. In propaganda, you are concerned in moving a mass of people, or trying to. In art, what you're really doing is doing your very best and then saying, take it or leave it. I'm sorry, but I cannot add anything to my plea to you to like this. If you don't like it, that's too bad. I'm sorry. And this is what I mean by having, in fact, an individual approach to every single separate reader. To every single separate reader, you're saying, in fact, take it or leave it. For that reason, I don't think that the writer can ever, insofar as he remains what I call a writer, the outsider writer, can ever be happy in a totalitarian state. Even if he thoroughly agrees with it. Because his kind of agreement must always be temporary and qualified. And the totalitarian state, by its nature, must decline this type of agreement. It doesn't like the provisional aspect of it. It doesn't like the fact that the needle is always trembling. It doesn't ever come to rest.
It takes a lifetime to become the best that we can be. We have not the time or the right to judge each other. It's one life, and there's no return and no deposit. One life. So make sure you like what's in your closet.
Here comes the music.
Here again is Sue Hodson, curator of literary manuscripts at the Huntington Library, home to the Christopher Isherwood papers.
Basically, I think he became more open over time in his sexuality and the way he portrays it in his books. It's really veiled in the Berlin stories. It's possible to read the Berlin stories and not really so much recognize that the character is a gay man and that it's written by a gay author. You can do that. I mean, I think the clues are definitely there. But if you're not really watching for them, people can read it, and there's some ambiguity there. In his later books, I think it's quite clear that his protagonist is gay, and it's a gay world in which he is circulating. So I think that's been a great and obvious change in his writing. I would also say that methodical patience with which he approached his writing was typical of his entire writing career. That didn't change. The way he approached his writing and the craft was constant throughout.
In 1937, during the rise of the Third Reich and fascism in Germany, Christopher Isherwood, along with W.H. Auden, wrote the tragic play The Ascent of F6. The play tells the story of Michael Ransom, a climber who, against his better judgment, accepts the offer of the British press and government to sponsor an expedition to the peak of F6, a mountain on the border of a British colony, and a colony of the fictional country of Ostnia. Ransom is destroyed by his haste to complete the expedition ahead of the Ostnian climbers. What we have to play for you today is extraordinary. On October 5, 1962, Christopher Isherwood and W.H. Auden adapted the play for radio. Here is Christopher Isherwood performing as the abbot, speaking to the leader of the doomed mountain expedition.
May we cease from our ignorance
and find the end of sorrow.
I hope everything has been arranged to your satisfaction, Mr. Ransom.
It is perfect.
I am glad. Please be seated. Come on. Will you do me the honor of taking a glass of wine with me? In these mountains, I fear we can offer but poor hospitality. But I think you will find this wine not totally unworthy of your palate.
Thank you.
Your health, Mr. Ransom. Now tell me, you wish to start soon on your ascension of our mountain?
Tomorrow.
You know the legend.
I have read the Book of the Dead.
Such interest, Mr. Ransom, is uncommon in one of your race. In that case, you will have comprehended the meaning of the ceremony that was performed this evening out in the courtyard. The office for the souls of the dead and the placation of the demon. I'm afraid that you, with your Western civilization, must consider us here excessively superstitious. No, you need not contradict me out of politeness. I understand. You see the painted mask and the horns and the eyes of fire, and you think this demon is only a bogey that nurses use to frighten their children. I have outgrown such nonsense. It is fit only for ignorant monks and peasants. With our factory chimneys and our furnaces and our locomotives, we have banished these fairy tales. I shall climb the mountain, and I shall see nothing. But you would be wrong. The peasants, as you surmise rightly, are simple and uneducated, so their vision is simple and uneducated. They see the truth as a crude and colored picture. Perhaps for that reason they see it more clearly than you or I, for it is a picture of the truth. The demon is real. Only his ministry and his visitation are unique for every nature. To the complicated and sensitive, like yourself, Mr. Ransom, his disguises are more subtle. He is, what shall I say, the formless terror in the dream, the stooping shadow that withdraws itself as you wake in the half-dawn. You have heard his gnashing accusations in the high fever at a very great distance. You have felt his presence in the sinister contours of a valley, or the sudden hostility of a copse, or the choking apprehension that fills you unaccountably in the middle of the most intimate dinner party. I did you an injustice just now when I said that you expected to see nothing on the mountain. You do expect to see something. That is why you are intending to climb it. You do not make that foolish, that terrible mistake so common among your fellow countrymen.
of imagining that it is fortunate to be alive? No. You know as I do that life is evil. You have conquered the first temptation of the demon, which is to blind man to his existence. But that victory exposes you to a second and infinitely more dangerous temptation, the temptation of pity, the temptation to overcome the demon by will. Mr. Ransom, I think I understand your temptation. You wish to conquer the demon and then to save mankind. Am I right?
So, you know of my vision in the crystal.
Ah, you saw it there too. That is not strange. For all men see reflected there some fragment of their nature, and glimpse a knowledge of those forces by whose free operation the future is forecast and limited. That's not supernatural. Nothing is revealed but what we have hidden from ourselves, the treasure we have buried and accursed. Your temptation, Mr. Ransom, is written in your face. You know your powers and your intelligence. You could ask the world to follow you, and it would serve you with blind obedience. For most men long to be delivered from the terror of thinking and feeling for themselves. And yours is the nature to which those are always attracted, in whom the desire for devotion and self-immolation is strongest. And you would do them much good. Because men desire evil, they must be governed by those who understand the corruption of their hearts and can set bounds to it. As long as the world endures, there must be order, there must be government. For by the very operation of their duty, however excellent, they themselves are destroyed. For you can only rule men by appealing to their fear and their lust. Government requires the exercise of the human will. And the human will is from the demon.
Supposing you are right. Supposing I abandon the mountain. And what shall I do? Return to England and become a farm laborer or a factory hand?
You've gone too far for that.
Well, then.
There is an alternative, Mr. Ransom, and I offer it you.
What?
To remain here and make the complete abnegation of the will.
And that means?
You saw the corpse in the procession. In the course of your studies, you have become acquainted, no doubt, with the mysteries of the rites of Chud. Celebrant withdraws to a wild and lonely spot, and there the corpse is divided and its limbs scattered. The celebrant, sounding on his bone trumpet, summons the gluttonous demons of the air to their appointed feast. At this moment there issues from the crown of his head a terrible goddess, and this goddess is his will, and she is armed with a sword. And as the ghouls of the mountain and of the sky and of the waters under the glacier assemble to partake of the banquet, the goddess with her sword cuts off the limbs of the celebrant's esoteric body, scatters them, and apportions his entrails among the demon guests. And the celebrant must wish them good appetite, urging them to devour every morsel. These rites, Mr. Ransom, are so terrible that frequently the novices who witness them foam at the mouth or become unconscious or fall dead where they stand. And yet so tedious is the path that leads us to perfection that when all these rites have been accomplished, The process of self-surrender can hardly be said to have begun. Well, Mr. Ransom, I must leave you now. Do not make up your mind at once. Think my proposal over.
Before I go, may I ask you a question? As abbot, you rule this monastery.
That's a wise observation. Mr. Ransom, I am going to tell you a secret which I have never told a living soul. We have spoken of your temptation. I am now going to tell you of mine. Sometimes, when I am tired or ill, I am subject to very strange attacks. They come without warning, in the middle of the night, in the noon siesta, even during the observance of the most sacred religious rites. Sometimes they come frequently. Sometimes they do not occur for months, or even years at a time. And when they come, I am filled with an intoxicating excitement, so that my hand trembles and all the hairs on my body bristle. And there comes suddenly into my mind strange words, snatches of song, and even whole poems. And these poems sing always of the same world, a strange world, the world of the common people, the world of blood and violent death, of peasant soldiers and murderers, of graves and disappointed lust. And when I come to myself again and see these monastery walls around me, I am filled with horror and despair, for I know that it is a visitation of the demon. I know that for me, nothing matters anymore. It is too late. I am already among the lost. Good night, Mr. Ransom.
Is it too late for me? I recognize my purpose. There was a choice once in the Lakeland Inn. I made it wrong. And if I choose again now, I must choose for myself alone, not for these others.
Here again is Sue Hodson, curator of literary manuscripts at the Huntington Library, home to the Christopher Isherwood papers.
The ascent of F6 comes from the period of time in the 1930s when Isherwood and Auden were, in almost a formal sense, a collaboration team. They were producing dramas especially together. They were working together, deriving more benefit from the thinking and the approach of one another. And they were setting out to do nothing less than completely transform British literature in the 20th century. And they were known throughout Europe and Britain as the most exciting young authors, along with Stephen Spender. The three were viewed as authors that everyone should be watching because they were going to transform the 20th century literature. And certainly they set out to do it. Isherwood and Auden did all sorts of experimental things in their plays, including The Ascent of F6. They wrote in verse. They had characters behaving and as the actors behaving as the characters in ways that other dramas had not employed. So they were moving, they were pushing the outside of the envelope to try to make a new medium, a new genre. And I think they succeeded.
Well, let's take a listen to more of Christopher.
Now, of course, there's no reason in the world why a writer should not participate in propaganda, that's to say, in trying to move people along a certain course of action. But I think that when he does so, he must really try to keep the difference between propaganda and art very, very clear in his mind. You see, the terrible thing about art, which is the search for significance in life, is that you may very well find that the bad thing is more interesting and therefore more significant to you than the good thing. You write about a concentration camp from the point of view of political propaganda. There's absolutely no question about it. These people are behaving in a way which must be condemned 100%. And in propaganda, you are concerned, therefore, to list the crimes and, above all, the things done to the victims. But in art, you may very well say, yes, yes, the victims. The victims are not being particularly interesting at this moment. What is really terribly interesting to me is why anybody would make a lampshade out of human skin or do some other incredible horror, the kind of behavior which is characteristic of the sort of psychotics who run these places. Or again, the curious kind of apparently dry, bureaucratic man who gives these orders and remains an admirable family father and a regular attendant at divine service on Sundays. This gets to be so interesting that it is apt to deflect the artist from the task of propaganda, and quite rightly, because it is interesting, and since everybody ever born is potentially the creature of art, there's absolutely nothing, despite Life magazine, to say that you shouldn't be more interested in the man who runs the concentration camp than in one of the victims. Because writers make bad totalitarians, because even when they're laden with honors by the totalitarian state and created heroes of art and given free holidays wherever it's nicest to have a free holiday, just because of that, such artists are very apt to feel guilty. And in feeling guilty, they are moved to cover up their guilt feelings by attacking art itself and saying that propaganda is art, and that the art which I have been characterizing, the art connected with being an outsider, is bourgeois formalism or escapism or decadence or any of the other rude words which are used to attack such things when you don't feel good about it. Now, the culture in which we live has, I think, at present, a kind of vice which, of course, is a great challenge to the artist, and in some ways, to live in such a culture is quite exciting and challenging. The challenge is that we live in a culture, as many social psychologists have observed, of blandness, of the rubbing off of sharp corners, of smoothing things away, of using nicey-nice phrases which conceal the acute painfulness of being alive, which, even at its most painful, gives us its sharpest sense of beauty, its sharpest sense of awareness, and confers its greatest wisdom. In exchange for this, we have all the roundings of corners which kind of soothe us into the world of the advertisements, so that we live in a kind of as-if culture of enjoying what is advertised to be enjoyed. The other day, a case arose in point which would sound quite grotesque in any culture but ours. A friend was very sick indeed in hospital. A friend of his called to know what the news was. The nurse said, "I'm afraid it isn't too good." He said, "Oh, you mean the pains have started again?" And she said, "No, he was buried this morning." Now, we take this kind of thing as a matter of course, and yet really it chills the spine. This kind of terrible blanketing of everything is not really merciful. It's not in any sense desirable, I think. And I sincerely believe that art has a great function at the moment to pierce through this kind of complacency and to restate the very simple facts of human experience and make us feel them and not gloss everything over. In a famous scene in one of E.M. Forster's novels, you probably recall The Longest Journey, the boy says to this girl who has lost her lover, "You must mind, you must mind," because she seems to be freezing into a sort of impassivity. And this is a great human truth. And this is, I think, one of the things that art is all about. Now, this brings us pretty directly to a subject which has been raised a great deal lately, because we come on to the methods by which the artist attempts to pierce through this integument of blandness. One of the most spoken of and noticed lately is, of course, the employment of so-called pornography. Now, I should state here two things right away. I personally, as an enthusiast of civil liberties, am unconditionally opposed to interference with anything that anybody writes, whether I agree with it or not. I wouldn't ban Life magazine if I became dictator. But I don't think this is the whole of the answer by any means. If you're going to take the attitude that you know what pornography is, then we must examine what you think it is and see what it is. I can quite understand the simple position of saying that certain four-letter words are simply banned under all circumstances. This, as I say, offends my liberalism, but at least it is perfectly coherent and understandable. When, however, people start saying, "Oh no, I don't mind that, but there's some difference between pornography and art, and that if the four-letter words are used artistically, then it's all right. And if the..." I'm saying here four-letter words advisedly, and avoiding the question, of course, of so-called pornographic scenes and actions, because we can, I think more simply on the basis of the words. We say these words can be used artistically, and then it's art. They're used inartistically, and it's pornography. But after all, if one gets down to the crudest manifestation of so-called pornography, crude sentences describing actions, which are sometimes written on walls, then we see that, after all, this is simply a form of fantasy. And isn't fantasy art? And isn't perhaps pornography, when we don't like it, simply to be characterized as bad art? But certainly art of a kind. I'm quite unable to see where the distinction falls between these two things. I therefore respectfully suggest that all censorship of this kind should cease forthwith. And I believe there is a very, very strong aesthetic censorship and check which will inevitably operate and does operate among the writers themselves. Because four-letter words are nothing else but like certain very vivid colors in the palette. You use them too much, you lose your effect. You lose all the balance, you lose all the artistic interplay which is necessary for a work of art. And I submit that by and large, the most restraining influence on the writers would be simply the fact that they found that by firing so much ammunition, they produced no effect at all and found themselves without any ammunition left before the book was over. And then, of course, there is the always allowable and, after all, supreme censorship, which is the reader doesn't read the book. The only kind of censorship which one cannot object to, much as one hates them sometimes.
From the Vault, the series is broadcast on the Pacifica Radio Network with 5 stations in Berkeley, Los Angeles, New York City, Washington, D.C., Houston, Texas, and over 120 affiliates nationwide. This episode was produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres and executive produced by Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. We are now streaming and podcasting online at FromTheVaultRadio.org. For more information, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. For more information about the Christopher Isherwood Papers, visit the Huntington Library at huntington.org, huntington.org. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday.